Welcome back, clinical problem solvers. Maddie and Yusuf here. At CP Solvers, our mission is to make clinical reasoning accessible to learners worldwide. We invite you to join us for our live virtual morning reports, where we break down cases and sharpen our diagnostic reasoning together. Now over to you, Yusuf.
Thanks, Maddie. Just a quick reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not a substitute for medical advice. Patient details have been modified to protect their privacy, and the views expressed here are our own, not those of our employers. Now, let's dive into the case.
Enjoy the show!
You solve the diagnostic puzzle, but what happens after you prescribe? Amazon Pharmacy helps your patients start treatment faster with same-day delivery, transparent pricing, and 24/7 pharmacist support. Because the best diagnosis means nothing without medication access. Learn more at pharmacy.amazon.com/prescribers.
Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers. It's been a while, but we're back with a space learning series. I'm Alec, one of the members of the team. And yeah, I'm going to pass it around and we can all give updates about what's going on before we get a great case discussion today. So yeah, Ethan, tell me what's new in your life.
Hey, everyone. I'm Ethan, in case it went forgot since the last episode has been months ago. I'm still in my postgraduate general medicine training. And interestingly, this month I'm in acute psychiatric ward. So quite a new space for me and quite a different approach to psychiatric patients compared to internal medicine patients, like doing long interviews and doing evaluation for catatonia, things like that. The medication seems to be different. It's an interesting experience for me. Yeah. How about you, Mengyu? How's life been treating you?
Wow, that sounds amazing. I missed my time in residency and even back to medical school where I can learn everything comprehensively from scratch. Yeah, I have been missing out a little bit recently. I just returned from a trip in my home back where I grew up and kind of revisited some of the places and see all the changes that has happened in the past like 10 years. So it was quite impressive. How about you, Lyra?
Yeah, hi everyone, Lyra here. Yeah, great to be back. I also, just like Dr. Mengyu, returned from a stretch of trips lately. So I've been in Yerevan, Armenia, taking step one, currently waiting for the results. And also just got back a couple of days ago from the trip to Belarus. Very excited to be here.
Amazing. And yeah, as far as updates for me, my oldest child just started kindergarten. So that was exciting and, you know, sad moment, but she's off on her educational journey, hopefully not as long as us. But yeah, I think Lyra has an amazing case today to share with us. I'm really looking forward to getting started.
Yeah, I'm just in SLS mode and SLS vibe because it also feels like I presented the case years ago. So excited to present a good one to you guys today. Hope you enjoy it. Okay, so here we go with the first aliquot. And it's going to be a story about 34-year-old male who is presenting to the ED with 3 days of fever up to 40 degrees Celsius. So he says to you that it started quite abruptly and was poorly responsive to Tylenol and also was accompanied by quite prominent chills. He also endorses headache, which he describes as band-like, and he denies any photo of phonophobia. And on review symptoms, he also notices whole body pain, decreased appetite, nausea, and diarrhea. Otherwise, review symptoms was negative. So he denies any nasal congestion, sore throat, cough or shortness of breath, chest pain or abdominal pain, as well as vomiting or dysuria. Excited to hear what you guys think about this.
Yeah, maybe I can go first. Thanks, Lyra, for the great start. So just to summarize the case, we have a 30-year-old male with unknown baseline, presumed previously healthy, which we shall know later, presented with an acute febrile syndrome, which was responsive to antipyretics, and has some systemic features include whole body pains, decreased appetite, nausea, and with headaches and diarrhea, which seems to be quite mild without signs of hydration. And he has no signs of migraines like photophobias, but he describes the headache being at band-likes. And for acute fever in a young patient, I think the first thing I would prioritize is infections. And in every kind of infections, we need to define the host, which we, based on the current information, we cannot know if there's any signs of immunosuppression. So I'm going to assume he is immunocompetent. So common things being common, The most common infection includes urinary tract infections, community-acquired pneumonias, a cold like viral infections. But here, seems like he has no any signs of urinary tract infection symptoms, and there's no sore throats, although there's some myalgias and headaches, which could present a viral syndromes. Also, there's some signs of gastrointestinal duodenal symptoms, which would may present in the viral syndromes. And there is no upper airway syndromes, which supports a common things like a COVID or a influenza syndromes. We still need to consider non-infectious causes, but I think we need to define the host better to see if there's any past medical history which makes the prior rare things. But otherwise, we still need to localize the syndrome better for moving on. Yeah. Any thoughts on Alec and Mengyu?
Yeah, I love your thoughts, Ethan. I can also chime in a little bit. I loved how you focused on acute fibrosis syndrome and zoomed in on infection, which I totally agree. I also remember what we learned in this CP solver space about the comparison of commensal organisms and uncommensal organisms or exotic organisms, in that the latter usually presents with diffuse symptoms, like this patient who has whole body pain, nausea, vomiting, and all these symptoms that really suggest what seems to be an exotic organism. So I think knowing the, like you said, knowing the exposure and knowing where he could acquire this organism would be potentially very helpful. What do you all think?
Yeah, Mengyu and Ethan, I'm right there with you. I think, you know, one thing that I like to think about, especially in a young patient, is I agree of febrile illness definitely makes us think about an infection, but just taking a step back and recognizing, one, who the host is, just like Ethan says, what medications did they take, what background medical history do they have, if any. And that can really inform what's going on. And we can also think about, is this truly fever or is this hyperthermia? And I think the background here can really help us as well. Perhaps the patient has a more extensive psychiatric history and is on medications, or they were receiving a procedure, but I'm sure Lira will fill us in. I think I find it striking, in particular, just like Mengyu was saying about sort of exogenous or exotic organisms, that most people that have a febrile syndrome to 40, if you ask them to take a finger and point for you what's bothering them the most, they could pick a spot, right? Oh, my leg is on fire, right? They have cellulitis. Or my belly pain roots are really, really bad. I'm having 10 episodes of diarrhea a day. Or my head is hurting really bad. Or, you know, oh my gosh, my back hurts really bad. I'm having a lot of burning when I urinate. And this patient can't really point anywhere. So I think that really speaks to the diffuse nature of the disease and prioritizes outside of our sort of typical infections and something that's more exogenous, like a virus, or atypical infections, just like Mengyu was talking about. So yeah, just like you all, I can't wait to hear from Lira a little bit more about this patient's background to better define the immune status and to get a better sense of, beyond infection, what other things we need to consider in the differential. So Lira, yeah, I would love to hear more from you.
Yeah. Absolutely wonderful thoughts, guys. I was right there with you when I heard about this case. So at least for now, we don't have a lot of information about this patient, not about the foreground as well as background of the patient. So to help you frame the problem better, I'll give you the current state of the patient. So for example, in the emergency department where he presented, as for vitals, he was stable. He was febrile up to 39.4 degrees Celsius, which in Fahrenheit equates to 102.9 degrees Fahrenheit. He was tachycardic with heart rate up to 102, but the blood pressure was stable at the level of 120 over 70. Respiratory rate-wise, he was 21, a bit tachypneic, but saturation was good of 96% on room air. Exam otherwise was quite non-localizing. So on general exam, there was no lymphadenopathy, no jaundice, no rashes appreciated. His mucous membranes were quite dry. On pulmonary exam, it was completely clear, on cardiac as well. He was tachycardic, but it was regular rhythm. Otherwise, no murmurs, no GVD, no peripheral edema noted. Abdomen was also soft, non-tender, and no hepatosplenomegaly that we could palpate. On neuro exam, also no focal neurological deficits, no neck stiffness noted, and meningeal signs were all negative. I will give you some basic lab work performed in the ED as well. So as for CBC, nothing striking. His white blood cells were 3.7, so a bit lower in our lab. His DIF was 76% neutrophils, 15% lymphocytes, which was a bit lower than expected, 8% monocytes and 0% eosinophils. His platelets were 258. Hemoglobin was normal too at 14.4 with MCV of 90. So for the rest of the metabolic panel, his electrolytes were normal with sodium of 135 and potassium of 3.9. Glucose was normal as well at level of 100. Creatinine was a bit higher than his baseline at 1.35, with his baseline around 1. For liver function test, ALT was 31, AST was 41, alkaline phosphatase 96, and TBLE was 0.7, so basically all normal. Albumin was 3.6 with total protein of 6.6, and CRP was 86 with normal NLF being less than 10. Urinalysis was also checked, so specific gravity was a bit higher. There was also mild proteinuria noted with the level of 1 plus on dipstick, which was later quantified as 0.3 gram per deciliter. Otherwise, urinalysis was completely clear, and the patient was admitted then for further workup. Okay, Dr. Mingyi, what do you think about the exam and the basic labs?
Wow, that's such a wonderful presentation. Thank you, Lyra. Yeah, I'm trying to analyze the data, and surprisingly, other than the mild leukopenia, nothing really jumps out. And even that, it's hard to pinpoint on a certain type of infection. And the mild positive urine protein seems to be often in real practice nonspecific. I would repeat a UA to make sure, or I would quantify to see if that's a signal or a noise. So here, what we're kind of seeing is something maybe we could call exam negative inflammation. We have yet to obtain some imagings to see if what we're dealing with, if we could localize the infection to anywhere. But like Alec and Ethan also mentioned earlier, if we're dealing with an exotic organism, we might not have a localizing site of infection, but actually dealing with a more diffuse infection. And endovascular infection, for example, is one of the ones that we don't have a clear localization. Yeah, I think question is what we want to go from here. Curious to hear your thoughts, Ethan and Alec.
Yeah, thanks so much, Mingyu. I think with the information that Lyra gave us, I think the exam and the situation really just corroborates our history. There's nothing focal that we find. He has a very significant inflammatory syndrome confirmed by the fever on exam, the tachycardia, and then also the very high CRP. But we didn't necessarily need to lab to confirm that. And oftentimes, what sometimes happens in these patients is that you do more objective exam finding or labs or imaging, and you find something to focus on. And here thus far, we haven't really found that, which to Mengyu's point makes me think that whatever is causing this fever is probably something more diffuse and not focal. I do find the pulse temperature dissociation to be striking. You know, for a young person, I don't know what the baseline heart rate is, but for a temperature up to almost 40 degrees Celsius to have only a heart rate of 102 is interesting, which could maybe point to something that's an intracellular organism like a virus or a fungus or something. And then I think the physical exam, Lyra is an excellent clinician, but if I was examining this patient, I'm not going to be able to pick up, you know, subtle lymphadenopathy or hepatosplenomegaly or other things. So sometimes even if patients don't have focal symptoms, there's still a lot of utility in imaging them just to be sure that they don't have image positive and exam negative disease. I think the leukopenia here is fairly nonspecific and could fit with the syndrome, but the patient's absolute lymphocyte count is low. And so in that situation, really need to know the patient's HIV status, which would be of paramount importance. And yeah, beyond that, I think at this point I would be thinking, what would I do next to try and figure out what's going on? And I think the background of this patient, like Ethan discussed earlier, is really going to color things. You know, if we can get more of an exposure history, what the patient does for work, what the sexual history is like, what medications did they take? Can we get collateral information from the patient's family? But, you know, the height of the temperature is quite striking, as well as the pulse temperature dissociation. But I think to better target our next diagnostic investigations, I think knowing a little bit more about the patient's background would be quite helpful. But Ethan, I'd love to know what you're thinking about this as well.
Yeah, totally agree with Mengyu's and Alex's thoughts. I think the exams and labs are actually quite bizarre. The history, as both of you had already mentioned, abnormalities that's most striking is the lymphopenia, more specifically. Seems based on my calculations, the lymphocyte count is around like 550, which kind of like moderate lymphopenia, which makes the patient actually have some degree of immunosuppression. And as Alex said, an HIV status is a must check. We not have the med list right now, so definitely the ER will give us that later. But presumably, if there's no medication, then first is check the HIV status. And second point is that, just as Mengyu mentioned in the first aliquots, if it's an endogenous bacterial infection, usually we had neutrophilia instead of neutropenia. So more likely if it's indeed an infection, it's more likely to be an exogenous causes like virus, which also fits if you have lymphopenia, you have a T-cell impaired immunity and more likely to have virus infections, mycobacterial infections, and fungal infection. Although right now, fungus and mycobacterial infections does not fit the time course, but we all know that we can fool by the true time course by history a lot of times. And sometimes the chronic inflammation can be masked. So right now, framing it as a inflammation of unknown origin would be kind of appropriate, although the true definition still requires a cross-sectional imaging. So I agree with both of you, get an HIV test, and next step would be a cross-sectional imaging and exposures, and if there's any undisclosed vulnerabilities. Back to you, Lira.
Yeah, friends, I love the thought. This exam was not what I expected at all, and same for the lab, so I want to say bitches to you guys. It sounds like you have quite a diffuse acute hyperinflammatory syndrome, but also keeping in mind the mention that Alec noted that exam negative inflammation doesn't necessarily equate to non-focal inflammation, so we're definitely going to need some further workup, which I'm going to give you guys later. But as you just guys said, with the foreground being not quite revealing to us, at least, but you guys still made a great progress on determining at least the possibility and the top priorities in terms of etiologies of inflammation in this patient. But you also ask for a background to understand the patient better. And so, guys, your wish is my command. I'm going to give you the background of the patient now. So it was also quite non-revealing. For past medical history, there basically was none. He was previously completely healthy. For medications, there were also none besides Tylenol that he was taking the past couple of days to control the fever. For past surgical history, there was a very remote history of epithelial coccygeal passage closure 15 years ago when still he was a teenager. Social history was also notable just for smoking about 10 cigarettes per day, but otherwise was negative. But he was also an avid traveler. And in the past year, he visited Cambodia 6 months ago, as well as ski resort in Georgia 4 months ago, and Greece 1 month ago. And at the last stop in Greece, he reported a stray cat bite. Most recent trip was, though, to Vietnam a week ago. And he reports eating in the hotel, as well as some fresh fruits from the bazaar. He says that he tried to always wash them, but they were never peeled. He denies any ingestion of seafood. He also drank bottled or boiled water all the time that he was in Vietnam and didn't use any ice. He also denies swimming in recreational waters as well as wild animal contacts. He also didn't notice any mosquito bites, though he also denies using any mosquito protection or repellents. And before the trip, he received no vaccinations or malaria prophylaxis. Okay, Alec, what do you think about this information? You asked for the background. I give you the background I hope you were hoping for.
Well, Lira, I think this is more than I bargained for. So thank you so much for sharing such a history. So I think we get a sense that the patient's past medical history doesn't seem to be too particularly relevant at this time. He doesn't take any medications. The epithelial coccygeal passage closure, 15 years ago, I am probably going to ignore it at this point. It doesn't seem to be necessarily related. And it doesn't seem like it's something that's been recurrent for the patient to make me think that he has some underlying systemic disease that predisposed him to that. The social history, he does smoke. I can't necessarily put to mind in this moment how the smoking history may play in with his presentation, but could predispose him to potentially lung infections if he has underlying sort of structural compromise of his lungs related to the smoking. And then, wow, what a rich travel history. And Lira had done an excellent job understanding the patient's exposures, where they traveled and what they were doing. And a lot of times patients don't pay too much mind to this. And certainly this is something that when I see a patient, I have to go back and ask them 15 times because I always forget. So I think it's really interesting to have. I would say, having not traveled much to Southeast Asia in the past and to Eastern Europe, I'm not super well-versed in understanding what infectious diseases are endemic to these countries. So that's something that I would be looking up in real time. It seems like this syndrome is fairly acute. So the trips to Cambodia and Georgia, although fascinating, I think in that moment, I would probably be prioritizing things that have been happening a little bit more recently. So we'd be focusing primarily on the trips to Greece and to Vietnam. Stray cat bite. Yeah, I'm not a huge cat guy. Sorry, Lira. But cats can carry lots of different infectious diseases. A month ago, if it was related to a bite, is a little bit prolonged for something like Pasteurella, but certainly Bartonella could potentially be consideration, but we're lacking some of the other features there as well. In Vietnam, he did have some exposure to fresh fruits and was not using any protection or like chemical prophylaxis against malaria. So that would be something in returning travel that I would definitely be considering. You know, other things you could think about would be Salmonella typhi and, you know, some of the viruses like dengue and HIV as well, and then other potential parasites. So I think as well in this patient, the diffuse nature of the disease is still striking, in addition to the height of the fever without really any clear focality that we've found so far. So I think because of the extensive exposure history, cross-sectional imaging, even though it's hard to know exactly what the target is going to be really helpful. And then if we find that the patient has this hepatosplenomegaly or diffuse lymphadenopathy, I think that will be really helpful. And then I think as well in these patients, time point one is just one time point. And I think the evolution of the syndrome with time, including of the labs, will be super helpful. Because let's say on day three, you know, the hemoglobin is now 10 and the platelets are now 80, right? I think that can really frame things as well. And then let's say the patient is having recurrent fevers and they develop a new rash or the diarrhea becomes more prominent. I think that can give you clues as the disease evolves. And then as the pattern of the labs evolves, that can help, you know, filter your differential diagnosis as well. So for example, if thrombocytopenia becomes more prominent and AST and ALT go up, perhaps you're going to entertain the idea of more tick-borne illnesses and so on and so forth, however you play it. And I think the only additional history that I would want from Lyra is a sexual history, just because that could really help us prioritize other things as well that we may have missed. It won't preclude me from getting an HIV test, just because, you know, some patients feel less comfortable sharing that history with you, no matter how great rapport you have with them. So if we're able to obtain that, I think that would be very helpful. But I think those are my initial thoughts. I'd love to know, Ethan, what you're thinking.
Totally agree with all your thoughts. Seems like the most striking new information that we got from this is the extensive travel history. A point that I'll add to the great Alec analysis about the potential exposure regarding all these countries, including mosquito bites, we had risk for malaria, we had risk for endemic mycosis, we had risk for TBs, all things of that. I think a wiser approach would be like to define the clinical syndrome better before like triggering any specific infectious evaluations. So my thought is that I might want to pause a little bit and then first get a cross-sectional imaging first and define the problem better before a trigger and anything later. Yeah. Anything add to all this, Mengyu?
Yeah, what a beautiful discussion, Alec and Ethan. So yeah, I think now it seems that we are dealing with a fever in a returning traveler. And I think the pathogens to consider would include a few different categories. I think, Alec, you laid out all the necessary questions really well, and we already have most of them from this history. So like we can think about pathogens endemic to the area of travel, and we can think about pathogens associated with activities associated with the travel, or sexually acquired during the travel, or associated with the act of traveling, like busy airports or like exposure in the hotel. And then it could be unrelated to the travel. But I think, as you all laid out, in someone previously healthy with such extensive travel history, I think I agree with folks zooming on the recent travel. So I think practically I agree with getting cross-sectional imaging, further clues and training the labs, but also like thinking about exposure. I know like the lack of certain exposure, like cannot, like for example, lack of mosquito bites doesn't mean that the patient didn't have a mosquito bite. So I wouldn't totally rely on that. I think practically I would look up on the CDC website and maybe like search what could be endemic to Vietnam. As Alex said, I'm also not totally familiar with that area. So I would always refer to a secondary, like a source like the CDC to make sure I think about all the things, pathogens that you think about. But I agree with certain viral pathogens like dengue and others are very possible. So yeah, back to you, Lara.
Yeah, what an awesome thoughts, guys. I completely agree with all that you said. And the couple of things that you mentioned is that the background history was quite rich for such syndrome that the patient is presenting with, but it expands the focus to certain endemic diseases and exotic infections, but doesn't necessarily shift it. And yes, the first question is still, what is the problem that we're dealing with? So we'll try to define the problem as much as we can in the next aliquot. And another point that I love that you guys made is to watch out for the evolution of the syndrome and trending of the labs whenever we have some diagnostic vacuum going on at this moment in time. And yeah, this case is the next aliquot is going to involve a lot of evolution of the syndrome and the patient scores. So here we go. For the imaging, an unconscious CT chest was done and it was unremarkable. EKG was also done, and it just showed sinus rhythm with the rate around 96 without any other changes. Respiratory viral panel was also done just because of the exposures and the base rate, which included in a hospital influenza and COVID, and it was negative for both, and it was actually repeated a few times and remained stably negative. And the most interesting part comes next, which is lapse evolution over a couple of days after the patient was admitted to the hospital. So the CBC was trended, and his platelet count was dropping quite significantly from the 258 on admission to 57 after a couple of days. His hemoglobin was rising from 14 on admission to 17.1. Hematocrit was trending in the same direction from 41% to 50%. MCV remained stable at around 90. His white blood cells were also dropping. He presented already mildly leukopenic, but from 3.7, it dropped to 2.1, with the differential being 48% neutrophils, 13% bands, 27% lymphocytes. And also interesting thing happened to his liver enzymes. So when he was admitted, both ALT and AST were completely normal. But after a couple of days of admission, ALT was trending from 31 to then 151 to then 224. Same thing was happening to AST, but with a little bit higher values. So AST on admission was 41, then it was 306, and it peaked at 381. But with all this happening on the labs, clinically, patient remained stable, vitals remained stable all throughout the course of hospitalization and were unchanged from those on the admission. And there was no evidence of deterioration of the patient with no evidence of bleeding happening despite the decrease in platelet count. Okay, Ethan, back to you. What do you think about the patient scores?
Yeah, amazing. So now, great advice from Alec, from the last adequate works out. Seems like we see a significant evolution of the syndrome, especially from the labs. So seems like, first of all, seems like the CT chest was unrevealing, so not much for a lung parenchymal signatures here. But the more striking parts are the progressive, like a newly developed thrombocytopenia, worsening lymphopenia, mostly with some left shift with 13% bands and an elevated hemoglobin, as well as an AST predominant transaminitis. So just to frame it a little bit better, so this is a 34-year-old previously healthy male with an extensive travel history, presents with acute febrile syndrome with newly developed lymphopenia, thrombocytopenia, suspicious of hemo concentrations, with negative CT chest, as well as transaminitis. So regarding of this syndrome, first to consider is tick-borne infection. And interestingly, a lot of the patients with tick-borne infections does not notice that they had a tick bite. So a history of denying tick bite does not exclude any tick-borne infections. So for these patterns, the most important pathogens to consider includes the rickettsias and the ehrlichiosis, as well as anaplasmosis. Other than that, also, we also see signs of possible hemoconcentrations by the elevated hemoglobin. And he went to these tropical countries, so very high risk of mosquito bites. So we also need to consider viral infections, especially the viral hemorrhagic fevers. So like back to first Eliquot, we heard that he actually had headaches and some GI illness. So need to consider dengue fevers. I'm not sure if Ebola virus were in those countries, but dengue fevers, Ebola, hantavirus, and Crimean Congo viruses are all the possible causes. Other than that, typhoid fever is also a consideration as well. So what I do next would be sending serology first, ask for history about all those possible exposures and consider sending those serologies. But also, we seems like we didn't get imaging regarding of the abdomen to pelvis areas, which I think I would still obtain based on the fever of unordered natures. What do you think, Alec?
Ethan, excellent thoughts. I agree with all that. I think this is a young man struck by acute inflammatory syndrome that seems to be highlighted by sort of discordant elevation in the hemoglobin and thrombocytopenia suggestive of a vascular leak. And I think the viral hemorrhagic fevers and dengue are certainly the main sorts of infections that could do this. And I think those would be primary concerns. I think as well, this is a young man seemingly healthy. And he likely has a fairly robust bone marrow to overcome, you know, hemolysis. So I think ongoing trend of the labs too, if the patient later becomes anemic, the only one I would add to that would be malaria. But the current rise in the hemoglobin is a little bit less suggestive of that. But I don't really have much to add to your expert discussion. I think the one other virus that I think would just frame the rest of the patient's evolution would just be the HIV test, just because we haven't received that yet, just to understand this may just be one thing that's afflicting this patient, or what are the risk factors to have acquired other infections as well in that moment. But yes, I'd love to know what Mengyu thinks of all this as well.
Yeah, amazing discussion. I have nothing much to add. I agree. I think when I see the striking hemoconcentration, as Alec mentioned, is pretty unique. And I think about dengue fever and I think similar, yeah, and some other viral hemorrhagic shocks that, and actually when I look up like the most common febrile illness in a patient returning from Vietnam, like dengue fever also rise to the top. So I would definitely be sending the NS1 antigen, which will be positive in the early phase, and serology only turn positive after day 4 or 5. We'll be looking for like any sign of severe dengue shock syndrome. So I think watching the hemodynamics, the patient already had organ impairment. So I would say he had the warning signs for that criticality. I think another differential we could consider in this setting is HLH. And sometimes dengue could trigger a HLH-like pattern, just basically suggesting severe inflammation. So I'll be sending some HLH labs like ferritin as well, a coagulation and a lipid panel. Yeah, back to you, Lara.
Yeah, amazing thoughts, guys. You are definitely on the right track. So seeing this pattern of inflammation in these acutely inflamed patients was quite unusual because it's not something we see in patients hospitalized, for example, for community acquired pneumonia. So it's quite interesting. And we were already thinking, just as you guys, with the recent travel about certain exposures that the patient might have, but also separately working up the changes and the evolution of the labs that we got. So for liver injury, what we did is with especially this pattern of AST being higher than ALT and potential for malaria as well, we decided to rule out potential mimics. So like muscle injury with the CK being 19 in this patient, which was normal in our lab. And we also checked LDH for potential hemolysis, which was also normal and is quite sensitive for hemolysis as well. So we moved on to checking other etiologies of liver injury. So we did the hepatitis screen, which was negative for HAV, HBV, and HCV. The test that you were asking this whole time, HIV came back negative as well. We also checked RPR for syphilis, which was also negative in this patient. Unfortunately, we don't have CT of the abdomen available that quickly in our hospital. So we decided to proceed with the abdominal ultrasound with Doppler. So it just showed mild hepatomegaly, but the vasculature was patent, and also mild pleural effusion on the right was noted. So for the thrombocytopenia and the cytopenias for COPD in this patient, what we really wanted to rule out was DIC in this acutely inflamed patient with acute thrombocytopenia. So for the coags, they all were normal. So INR was 1.2, APTT was also normal, and fibrinogen came back normal as well. I love the thought about HLH from Dr. Mengyu, because this patient was really inflamed, and with developing cytopenias, it's something that we really want to rule out. So we checked the ferritin and it was just 450. We also checked the smear, which was basically clear. It didn't show any schistocytes. White blood cells were a bit decreased, but morphologically unremarkable, so no blasts or atypical lymphocytes were noted on the smear. Platelets were also decreased, but morphologically unremarkable as well. There was no clumping, but also on the staining, no parasites were noticed, and the smear was repeated a couple of times, just to be sure. We also were worried about intravascular infection, so the blood cultures came back negative. And the TTE just showed mild LVH with a junction fraction of 60%. IVC was non-dilated and it was compressible on inspiration, and no agitations and no significant valvular pathology was noted, as well as there was no evidence of pericardial effusion in this patient. So after a long time spent thinking about this patient, we decided to send a diagnostic test, which was a send-out test in our lab. Curious, what do you guys think about this presentation so far?
Yeah, Lira, just again, excellent presentation. And so we see that the CK, which is something that I love that Lira sent and taught us, that, you know, when the AST is elevated higher than ALT, don't always want to assume that it's from the liver. It could be from the muscle as well. So I like that we excluded that along with the LDH to be sure it's not from the red blood cells or someplace else. The viral hepatitides were all negative. The HIV, fortunately, was negative. And I think, you know, the patient doesn't seem to have any significant coagulopathy. The smear hasn't shown any schistocytes, fortunately, no blasts, and no parasites. Sometimes malaria can be very difficult to pick up on the smear, but it seems like it was done twice. There could be antigen testing done, but I think the evolution of the clinical syndrome and two smears make that a little bit less likely. Ensuring the blood cultures were negative and that the patient didn't have like a disseminated endovascular infection was also really important. So I'm glad to hear that the blood cultures were also negative. And it seems like on the right upper quadrant ultrasound, it didn't really show too much pathology, but it did show a pleural effusion. And we see that the heart seems to be hyperdynamic. And despite, I assume, the patient being resuscitated, that the IVC is quite compressible. And I think that just fits with the idea of vascular leak and the hemoconcentration. So I think overall this syndrome, with all the diagnoses that Ethan and Meg you outlined, is potentially very suggestive of dengue. So if we frame this as, you know, a young man who's returning from Vietnam, who is coming in with a diffuse inflammatory syndrome that is characterized by, you know, deep thrombocytopenia and polycythemia with signs of vascular leak on exam with elevated AST and ALT without evidence of hemolysis, potentially could support that as well. But I'd love to know from Ethan or Menu if you're framing the case a little bit differently.
Yeah, I agree with Alex's discussions. All the negative blood cultures suggest against an endovascular infections and a smear, and there's no malaria, things like that. And there's also no evidence of hemolysis, which also I love that Lira also mentioned that a normal LDH essentially without a hemolysis, and there are also no muscle injuries. And from Vietnam, the most common viral hemorrhagic fevers are from dengue fevers. And the second would be a hantavirus. So I agree with Alex's analysis about the most likely being dengue virus. So the most sensitive and specific tests are the viral PCRs, especially if patients are lymphopenic and may not amount enough immune response to produce an IgM. So sending a PCR for the RNA of the dengue virus would be my choice. Or the NS1 antigen ELISA test, as Mengyu suggested, is also very sensitive and specific. Yeah. Mengyu, nice to you.
Yeah, I agree with you both. I imagine management-wise, the patient would have received broad-spectrum antibiotics plus doxycycline while awaiting all these results. But at this point, I think management-wise would be supportive care and observation with IV fluids and fibril syndrome control. Avoid like NSAIDs due to the bleeding risk while sending all the tests that Ethan mentioned earlier. Back to you, Lira. I can't wait to hear the outcome of this patient.
I anticipated a great discussion, but you guys, it was absolutely brilliant. And just to remind everyone, I practice in St. Petersburg, so even suspecting dengue fever in a patient here is like seeing water on Mars. So it was quite a hard time finding a lab that could actually perform diagnostic testing for the infections that you guys mentioned. So we found a private lab which had available only PCRs and serologies. Unfortunately, in our city, we don't have NS1 antigen testing available. So we sent what we could send. We sent malaria PCR, which came back negative. We also checked chikungunya, Zika, and West Nile PCRs, which also came back negative. But again, we're having quite high pretest probability of dengue fever in this patient, especially after, again, as you guys mentioned, researching what infections are endemic in Vietnam, where the patient traveled recently. And dengue is quite endemic and active in Vietnam all year long. So as we anticipated, dengue PCR came back positive, and later serologies came back positive for IgM2. So fortunately, the hospitalization course for these patients was uncomplicated without development of shock or hemodynamic instability. He was mentioned supportively with IV fluids mostly, and with trending of the CBC and liver tests as well. And they completely improved, I think, in about a week. So after the labs returned to baseline, the patient was discharged and was doing well otherwise. Yes, curious to hear your guys' reflections. I really enjoyed discussing this case with you.
Thanks for the case, Lira. Definitely an amazing case. Yeah, my biggest reflection is that about like in earlier LA course, we see the lymphopenia and frame it as a diffuse syndrome, and more likely to be an exogenous organism instead of an endogenous organisms, which I think frames the problem very nicely, even before the extensive trial history, which shows the how neutrophilia versus neutropenia really tells us, and the importance of like framing the clinical syndromes before sending all the extensive evaluations. Yeah. Any thoughts, Alec?
Yeah, Ethan, excellent reflections. And Lyra, thanks again for putting such an amazing case together. And I think I share Ethan's sentiments about framing the problem and sort of recognizing the discordance of how inflamed the patient was without being able to put your finger on where the problem exactly is. Really speaks to something exogenous and something that's potentially in the blood otherwise. I think as well, I think the pulse temperature dissociation here was potentially helpful. The patient wasn't on a beta blocker and had a temperature of 40 Celsius, so like 104 degrees Fahrenheit, but had a heart rate that was basically normal, which I think really speaks to intracellular organisms such as dengue. And I think, you know, like Ethan says, that can maybe doesn't necessarily make you want to narrow your differential diagnosis completely, but certainly can help you give clues to what organisms you potentially might want to prioritize, especially in Lyra's case, where you may not have access to every test that you want to send. So being able to pick those appropriately. But yes, Mengyu, I'd love to hear what your reflections are as well.
Yeah, I love both of your reflections. And I really enjoyed learning from you, like how you frame the case as the case progresses, and especially like how we started with an exam negative acute febrile illness, then proven to be kind of image negative, and then also the importance of training the lab and reveal the pattern that would be suggestive of the final diagnosis, and combining with demographic to provide the final clue to the diagnosis. So yeah, such a rich case and such a wonderful presentation, Lyra. Thank you so much for bringing the case.
No, thank you all, guys. I think this discussion was really, really brilliant. I learned a lot, and it's especially helpful to also learn from different perspectives of how different people think. So I guess my main big picture reflection after this case is just the simple message of always keep your mind open, because this case, especially in the setting where I practice, so in the city that doesn't really see dengue that much, could easily led to two opposite types of thinking. First would be anchoring too early on an exotic diagnosis after hearing the patient's background. And this could easily be a case of simple flu or COVID in a patient who has just got exposed on a plane to this infection. So the base rate still remains the base rate even when you add some new pieces of history. And the second way could be basically the opposite, is anchoring on the diagnosis that you're comfortable with, that you know, and being reluctant to think outside that box. So actually, the ID consultant on the case was quite certain that this was just an atypical case of influenza. But when the picture doesn't really fit, like in this patient, and the testing, even repeated testing, is negative, and in the patient who is that inflamed and has no respiratory symptoms, just don't be afraid to think outside the box and dig deeper. So a big shout out to my colleague whose patient this actually was in real life, for staying curious, trending all the labs as you guys were suggesting to do, and continuing to push the diagnostic workup, coordinating with the private labs to get the diagnostic clarity for this patient. And of course, shout out to the CP Solvers community and you guys specifically for being the representation of what it means to be curious in medicine.
Masterful as always, Lyra. And I think just another sense of time being one of the best diagnostic tests. Not only time to learn about patients, to learn about diagnoses, to see a disease evolve and to leave more clues along the way. And time to just to continue and learn and grow together. But hopefully not quite as much time between our episodes. So until then, hope you all stay well. Happy CP solving.
That's a wrap, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to be part of our community, join us for our live virtual morning report, where you can present the case or discuss with us. Visit our website for details. We would love to have you.